Now let's move on to our next speaker. He's going to address one of the fundamental questions undergirding this seminar. Do we know enough to prevent juvenile crime? You know, research in the last 3 decades has taught us a lot about aggression and how it develops. Interestingly, as you'll find on page 18 of the briefing report, aggression appears to be quite stable, much like IQ. For example, those children whose classmates say they are highly aggressive at 8 years old go on to commit more crimes as adults. So at age 30, these highly aggressive 8-year-olds commit more crimes, commit serious crimes, violate traffic laws, drive while drinking, and seriously abuse their children. Now, this is a very intriguing finding, but it leaves unanswered some important questions, which our next speaker is going to address. What leads to aggressive behavior in children? Are all juvenile delinquents the same? And are youth who commit occasional and nonviolent crimes different from those who commit frequent and violent crimes? Now, the answers to these questions, I think, leads to the possibility of prevention. And our next speaker is from the Oregon Social Learning Center in Eugene, Oregon. For the last 3 decades, they've been doing what I think is some of the premier research in this country on the development of antisocial behavior in children. These findings on the different types of juvenile delinquents have been corroborated recently by a scientist here in the UW-Madison campus, Dr. Temi Moffat, who would love to have been with us today but is in New Zealand doing research. She flew out on Sunday, but her name and address are on page 39 of the briefing report if you'd like to contact her. Lou Banks has worked with Gerald Patterson and several other associates at the Oregon Social Learning Center since 1983. He completed his undergraduate training at the City College of New York and his PhD at UCLA. He's well qualified, I think, to speak to us today because he's worked with youth in so many different capacities. Early in his career, he was an elementary school teacher, and in his present position, he does research, but he also works as a therapist and also works as a prevention programmer. He has over 40 publications, I won't go through all of them, primarily on the development of antisocial behavior in children and adolescents, as well as clinical and prevention strategies for diminishing or stopping these behaviors. So I'm very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Lou Banks.
Thank you. Thank you, Karen. And I'm really pleased to be here. This is my first time that I actually even heard of Family Impact Seminars when I was invited by Karen Bogenschneider to come. And I think this is just an incredible thing that's going on here. And I'm hoping after this I'm going to be able to take some of this back to Oregon, actually, and we may try to do it there. I have allotted to me 25 to 30 minutes, I've been told. I can talk for a long time. And so I'm going to try to be real careful to make just a few points that I think are most important. And I hope that all of you, or at least many of you, will be able to stay for the roundtable discussion. I think in many ways that will be a real critical event this morning when we get to really talk about some of these things. I want to start out by saying I have two points that I want everyone to hear just before we get involved in discussions of nuances and details. And number one, we do, as Karen was saying in the introduction, we do know a lot about the development of antisocial and delinquent behavior. We really do. What that means is it should be possible to prevent and to intervene at various points along what I'll call the developmental trajectory. And by that, I mean growing up. So from when children are very small till we become adults, there are many points along the way that may be useful for intervening, may be helpful. There is no one magic thing, as I'm sure you're all aware by now. that is going to solve this problem. So that's the first point, that there, I believe that there is enough evidence to help us to move in the right direction. The second point is that there are many different kinds of interventions that have been developed, prevention ideas, treatment ideas, depending on the age of the children, depending on the kinds of things that they've been involved with, depending on the decade in which the ideas were developed. We're going to talk about a lot of those. I'm not going to try to convince you that any one or two or three are the right things to do. What I am going to try to convince you of is that whatever you invest the monies and time and energy of people in this state, that you do it in a very careful manner. We have, in this country and in many countries, a very long history of failure in this field with very little success. And I don't just mean the 90s or the 80s, I mean just about this whole century. This has been an issue that has attracted a lot of attention without success, without much success at all. The way I'm recommending you deal with that is by designing at the start, wherever you put your money and effort, designing a way to evaluate the efficacy of what it is you're doing. Because without that, everyone who goes into this business is well-intentioned. There are a lot of us who really, you know, care about kids and want to make a difference. I suspect, you know, all of us here are those kinds of people. That doesn't mean what we do is going to work. We're going to feel good about it, people are going to work hard, and it's going to look to most everyone on the front lines like it's making a difference. But unless there are data, unless you can compare the results of one great intervention effort to perhaps just what's the status quo in another town, in another area, maybe in the same neighborhood, unless you can do that, you're not going to know if it really helped. And then there's going to be big arguments whether it did or not. And in the end, I think everyone will lose if you can't say whether it helped or not. Okay, so those are the two critical points that I wanted to make. Maybe we can have the first slide. I'm going to talk a bit now about our theoretical perspective. This has been developed at the Oregon Social Learning Center. Jerry Patterson, John Reed, others who have been there for decades. I'm relatively a new kid on the block, only 11 years, so that's it. That's where I started. But this is a rendition of the model that we call the vile weed. And the idea is to show, number one, that it is a connected process. We're not talking about kids who, you know, everything was going just fine and then one day they came home and became delinquents. We're talking in large part about kids who, if you look at the roots in that figure, who had a lot of strikes against them at the start. And I don't think you can see that in the back, but I can't see it from here either. But things from the way that their grandparents parented their own parents. So how did their parents develop some kind of skill at parenting? There's what we were just talking about quite a bit, the whole idea of poverty. we break down into a number of different variables that might class as social advantage or disadvantage, but those things surely matter too. The critical thing in our model coming up from the roots is going to be the skills of the parents. We call those skills family management skills. I noticed in Karen's report right at the start that there was an impact seminar within the last 6 months or so, I think, on how government or can government impact on parenting. I don't know what you concluded that day, but I hope you concluded that you could make a difference, because our model suggests, and very strongly so, that that is where we have to move. Because if we can't make a difference coming out of those roots with parenting practices, we can't change what's already happened in the past, but if we can't make a difference with parenting practices, then this developmental process, the growth of this vine, as it's depicted here, is something that is very likely to continue. There is, in some of our work, we've talked about aggression and antisocial behavior as a trait. As Karen mentioned, the stability of aggressive behavior is very much parallel to IQ, which has been the most stable phenomenon psychologists have discovered, at least. Why don't we go on to the next one? On the positive side here, just looking at the kinds of parenting that are going to help, we've isolated a number of variables that we believe are critical. One, we want to call monitoring, is how parents supervise their kids. And as you could imagine, that changes considerably from an infant to a toddler to a grade school child to an adolescent. We're talking about very different skills. And in fact, the importance of monitoring in, as far as delinquency goes really increases as the child becomes more and more mobile. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that soon. Effective discipline. Parents need to know how to discipline their children. That the technology of discipline is well understood now. We could, maybe we'll talk about this later, I could tell you, many of you may know, some basic parenting skills that are necessary to effectively discipline. But it's much harder to get people to do these things on a consistent basis than it is to say what they are. It says positive reinforcement next. I'll use another term for that. Say parent involvement is another critical variable that I think the label is clear enough for now. And finally, problem solving. And by that, what we mean is a way that a parent can go to a child to discuss things that a child can learn from the parent when the child needs to say, wait a minute, maybe, you know, you've told me this is what I have to do, mom or dad, but I'd really like to do this. You know, what is there a process in a family where a child has the ability at least to bring that up? And learning that process is something that we've found to be very important. Next slide, please. I think this slide may be very difficult to see from the back. I'm just going to make one quick point from this slide. Way over on the left, where it starts with child and parent with a little dance of behavior. But if a child misbehaves, as all children do, you know, how does the parent respond? If the parent is unskilled with discipline, A common response is with some kind of coercive behavior. It could be spanking, it could be yelling, it could be some other kind of behavior where the parent, let's say, takes charge, but does so in a coercive manner. If you continue that dance, and what we see, and we actually go into homes and observe children and families, and we've done that with many hundreds of families over the years, what you see is a repetition of that dance over and over and over again. It only takes a few seconds to do that. And every time, it becomes a little bit stronger response for a child, so that 5,000, 10,000 times, I don't know what the number is, but that number of replays of this little dance happens pretty quickly. In many cases, by the time a child is 2 years old, 3 years old, that child learns that that's the way to respond. In a difficult situation, you use some kind of coercive response. Unfortunately, that works really well for kids. If you think about little children, among all little children, there are relatively high rates of grabbing for what you want, maybe pushing, maybe hitting sometimes. Those behaviors tend to work pretty well when you're 2 years old to get what you want in that moment, especially if there isn't an adult present to correct that and to teach another way to try to get what you want. Given how quickly those repetitions can take place, it doesn't take long for a child to develop that style of interacting. By the time a child enters preschool and certainly kindergarten and elementary school, though we see those patterns as already very strong in a substantial number of children. The response by other children is to get away from that child. We call that rejection by peers. Sensible label. That also turns out to be very bad for kids. We can go on to the next slide. Once kids have developed this kind of behavior pattern, the likelihood that other bad things will happen tends to increase. In this slide, this just shows a progression from being antisocial, as we call it there, when the kids start school. Actually, this is fourth grade over on the left, is where we were funded to start on that study. The likelihood of being rejected by other kids was about half of the kids. Once they were rejected, the likelihood of then hanging out with other kids who nobody else wanted to be with was about a third of those kids. And once they were hanging out with what we call deviant peers there, the likelihood of being arrested, now this is only by the sixth grade, I should say, was 11% in one sample, 13% in a second sample. That covered, that was out of the whole sample. It covered about 80% of the kids who were noticed by authorities. The other kids who were noticed by authorities also came through the same loops there, but missed one of those steps. Either they weren't rejected by peers, or they were rejected, but they were not associating with deviant peers. But it was a very small number. Most kids actually went through those steps as depicted there. I should also say that by the time these kids reached age 18, which was a couple of years ago, about half of them had been arrested. And the best predictor of whether they would be arrested or not were those earlier variables. OK, Hey, Karen has given me a note already. I've used up half of my time, but I think this was something I really wanted to take some time on. This is what we call the theoretical model. We're pretty darn sure that this is the way it happens. Not only have we done this work, but it's been replicated in a number of places in this country and in other countries. I think what I'd like to do for the next 10 or 15 minutes that I have is spend a few minutes on each of a number of questions that Karen asked me to address. The next slide, please. On this slide, this is the whole big picture again, but if you look over to the right-hand side where there aren't so many words and boxes, you can see that by the time kids have gone through the kind of process I was talking about, what we have is right in the middle there, a commitment to a deviant peer group, and that is associated with delinquency. And then that moves on to substance abuse down in the bottom right, and from several directions, chronic offending later on. Could we kind of, I think it's the last slide in the pile. Yeah. That one. You might take a few seconds to adjust to the, it's supposed to be three-dimensional, but what that shows is over a five-year period, this was with 200 boys, those kids who were least supervised, that's what we mean by wandering, and who most associated with deviant peers were by far the most likely to be arrested. We're not talking about little differences here. You can see way back in the corner the interaction of no or very little supervision and having the opportunity to associate with deviant peers is real bad news, real serious bad news. I want to talk just a little bit about prevention for a few moments here. And I think things get a bit sometimes because clearly our work shows that the best place to intervene is as early as possible. It's the most cost-effective. It's the easiest time to impact on a child's behavior. When they're very little, before all of this other real bad stuff has ever happened. It makes the most sense to intervene then. There are big problems, though, with how you do that. I mean, how do you walk over or call up or however you're going to do it, how do you get to a parent and say, look, your child, we're really afraid your child is at risk. I know he really looks cute, and it seems like a great kid, but we have reason to believe that your child is in for big trouble later down the road. It's not going to work. So, and that even, that's just the tip of the iceberg, really. We call this problem, or I call it access. How do you get access to the people who need help? It's very, very difficult. Many studies have shown that try as they might, when you make things available to people, generally the people who need it the least tend to be the ones who come the most, and vice versa. In prevention, one of the ways we deal with this is what we call a universal intervention. That is, everybody gets it. You do this in a whole neighborhood, a whole community, maybe a whole city or a whole state. In Norway, there's a psychologist who's convinced the whole country to do it and has had some good success. Maybe we could talk about that at the round table. Karen asked me to mention some of the work that's been done with early prevention. And I'm not going to go into any detail on it. There are clearly some promising programs. They have the same problems, though. That is, how do you, you know, it's one thing to have a study with 10 or 50 or even 200 people that you get to participate. And you should know, in a lot of the studies that are done and that we do, we pay people to answer questionnaires, to come for interviews, to let us come into their homes to observe them. That helps a lot when you want people to participate with a program, when we're paying them. And that's a whole other area that I won't talk about now. There are certainly those people who say, well, maybe we should just pay people to do a better job as parents, but I won't say any more about that now. How do we get people to participate? How do we have access? It's the same problem with any of these interventions that show some very nice success. How are you going to do this on a large scale? And what I'm calling a universal intervention is the best way that we know so far. We can talk later at the round table about specific ideas and specific ways within a universal intervention that we've been using and that we are using now in several prevention studies. I'm going to swing over to the other side now. We could still call it prevention, but having said that, the best place to intervene is with children and their parents as early as possible. That doesn't change the fact that we have huge numbers of kids in middle childhood and adolescence with tremendous problems, and we can't abandon them. And even if not for altruistic sorts of reasons that we really want these kids to have good lives and all of that, I think, as Stefan said, it's in our face every day. There are lots of bad things happening out there, and even for those folks who may not be that worried about the future of those kids themselves, all of our futures are really tied up together with these kids. I have 5 minutes left. I'll try to make two points with this. One, we make a distinction between early and late starters. The kids who start early have the most severe trajectories in general. I think Karen made that comment at the beginning. That's well established at this time. If you look at the statistics, the biggest rise in crime is between the ages of about 12 and 14 or 15. After that, by the way, the rates slowly, gradually come down. So just as an aside, so anybody who looks to see, if you intervene with teenagers and you work real hard with them from 12 to 15 and then see if it had an effect, they will always look better because everyone does. It's part of growing up. So that's a bad mistake to evaluate things that way. With an early intervention, hopefully we're intervening on a lot of those early starters before they get started. Late starters are kids who may have been marginal, and indeed, we have found that the variables in our model are the very same ones that predict arrests for late starters as early starters. The difference is simply that late starters have more going for them earlier in their lives, and at some point often in adolescence when they're bigger and maybe their parents are less skilled in dealing with them as adolescents, or something else happens, divorce, loss of a job, living in a neighborhood with gangs or other kinds of deviant peers, something that pushes that kid over the line. We clearly need prevention efforts there too. And we can talk more about those, I hope, at the round table. I want to talk about violence, I think, for my last couple of minutes here, since that's a hot topic, and it is for us too. I want to share with you a couple of scientific findings and what I think is the state of the art at this point. As a psychologist, I can tell you we have a really sad history of predicting dangerousness and violence. We're often asked to do so in a court of law. It's really hard to do. Over the years, many people have thought that we can predict violence through a variety of variables. For example, poverty. Does that predict violence? Well, not exactly, not really. There may be some higher rates in lower socioeconomic groups, but it's very hard to pin down. Various theories about what predicts violence have not worked. There are two studies that have been done very recently, one in London by David Farrington, and one by my colleagues Deborah Capaldi and Jerry Patterson, in Eugene over the last decade or so, and they both show exactly the same thing, and that is no predictor variable from early on, and they both of these studies were collecting data on these were all boys, by the way, on these boys from about age 10 or so and on, no early variable predicted later violence. But in both studies, there was very clear and very strong prediction of violence by what we could call exposure to, let's say, exposure to crime. I can probably do better than that if I could think about it for a minute. But those kids with the highest frequency of contacts with the police were the kids who were most likely to eventually be involved in a violent crime. Now, in a way, this is very commonsensical and very simplistic, but in another way, it's really very powerful. I mean, obviously, we want to cut down on juvenile crime. It turns out, in a third study that is still underway that I've been conducting with a colleague of mine, we have 100 kids who were adjudicated, who were what we call multiple offenders, who were arrested many times, frequently for felonies. We did not take the very most violent. That is, if we thought that they would be dangerous in the community, for example, one kid had put cyanide in his father's coffee. We thought we did not want to place people in the community in the position where they might be in danger with that child. Another kid lit his parents' bed on fire when they were sleeping in it. We didn't take that kid. But we take most kids, including kids who've committed very serious crimes and violent crimes. What we found was, in a treatment foster care program that I hope we'll get to talk about later, with trained foster parents, the kids who had committed violent crimes were no less likely to stay in those programs and to benefit from them, to graduate from them, than kids who were delinquents who had never committed a violent crime. And when they graduated from our program, which was about a 6 to 8 month proposition, they were no more likely to commit a violent crime. And these kids were all out in the community. They were no more likely to commit a violent crime than the kids who went through the program who had never committed a violent crime before. In fact, There were still violent crimes, much fewer, but there were still some after our program. And the only predictor, and it was a good predictor, of those later violent crimes, again, was frequency of arrests following graduation from our program. In other words, kids who, again, back to the supervision and deviant peer association, if they're out there on the streets, nobody's supervising them, and they have the opportunity to be with other kids who are getting in trouble, sooner or later, the odds are they're going to be involved in some kind of violent activity. Maybe not by choice. In many instances, we think that that was not what they set out to do. But that's what they got. Well, I'm afraid I've missed many of the things that I wanted to talk about, but I know I've hit on a few that were real important to me to tell you about. So I hope we'll get to talk about the other things later. Thanks.
We have time for one question. Any questions for Lou? Yes, Senator Moore.
Right, I sort of missed out on your noxious weed example, but you took it off the overhead too. I was wondering if you had copies of that.
I did not make copies, but we sure could make some. I'd be happy to leave that with Karen. Yeah.
If you'd like one, just mention it to the research, my research assistant on the way out. We'd be happy to mail you one. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Bergeron.
Is there any current research or theories about why the quality of crimes that juveniles are committing seem to be getting so much more violent, or is that just a perception, or is anybody looking at that?
The question is, are crimes getting more violent? Is that a perception? If not, why are crimes becoming more violent?
I can't say that I have the answer for sure, but I can speculate for a moment. Clearly, the frequency of juvenile crime is up, and up tremendously. The frequency of violent crime, the latest statistics that I recall at this moment, at least nationally, in 1991, 7,000 juveniles died primarily at the hands of other kids under 18. That's a lot, clearly, and many, many more who were injured and so on. In line with what I was just talking about at the close of my talk, I think it is the case that with an increased frequency of crime in general, there will clearly be an increase in violent crime. And it may be, and we don't understand this so well, it may be that it's not just a, you know, for every five crimes, there's one violent crime kind of relationship. And I just made that number up, by the way. But rather, as you up the ante, as you take kids and put them out on the street and they're out there with other kids and feeling free or to some extent free to commit crimes, that the frequency of violent crimes could indeed skyrocket. That's very consistent with what we see from the data we have so far. When you say the quality of violence, do you...
Gross violence. I mean, maiming people and unnecessary... I mean, it's more than just hurting somebody or killing somebody. It's maiming them. And like you mentioned a few.
Right. Well,
people on fire.
I think to some extent, maybe a large extent, and I'm not really certain about this, that is a perception that may be false. In Great Britain, the two 10-year-olds that killed the 2-year-old last year, that galvanized the whole country in Great Britain, and unfortunately, a lot of things that I think were not such great ideas came out of that there in Great Britain. But it was the same notion that, oh my God, you know, now it's really happened. The kids have gone over the edge. and they're going to do these really crazy, horrible things. And I think that's not the truth. The truth is that juvenile delinquency, in many ways, is very similar to what juvenile delinquency has been for many years. But I think we do have more of it now.
And there is some information in the briefing report in Linda Hall's section on the amount of violent crime in Wisconsin, the increases, and it comprises about 2% of all juvenile crimes.